Virtual instrumentation is a new tool in tracing signs of water in the solar system. This is Western Worlds. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissy, speaking to you from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The combination of remote sensing and geology have demonstrated a synergy that has become an invaluable tool in planetary science. The effect of this is now being further accelerated by the use of what are known as virtual instruments. Tim Glotch is Associate Professor at Stony Brook University and Principal Investigator of one such instrument, RISE-4E, investigating mineralogy on the Moon and Mars. Let's go to the interview. Okay, hi Tim.
Hi.
Good to have you over here in Western Worlds and good to speak to you.
Well, thank you for having me, I appreciate it.
Why don't we start by discussing a little bit about your background?
Sure.
How did you get to be the PI on this instrument and professor at Stony Brook University looking at Mars?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I've always been a space geek, basically. And when I was an undergraduate, I actually started out in a physics and astronomy program. But I had a couple of really good undergraduate summer internships, which were more planetary science related. And in the same time, I did some more undergraduate research, which was more astronomy and physics related. And I was able, after a couple of years, to figure out that I was much more interested in things that are close to us than things that are far away. So I was much more interested in the planets than I was about pulsars or variable stars or galaxies or anything like that. So I thought, if I want to study planets, I better know something about rocks. So I transitioned into a geology program. I ended up with something close to a double major in physics and geology. I went to graduate school in geology. I had the good fortune of working under Phil Christensen at Arizona State, who, besides being a fantastic advisor, was also the principal investigator for the thermal emission spectrometer, which was in orbit around Mars, the thermal emission imaging system, which is a camera in orbit around Mars, two miniature thermal emission spectrometers, which were on the rovers, the Mars rovers. And so that was really how I got into Mars research. I did a postdoc after I graduated at Caltech, where I studied under George Rossman, who's one of the premier mineralogists and spectroscopists in the world. And there is where I really learned how to do laboratory work. And eventually I got to Stony Brook, where I combined the remote sensing the skills that I learned under Phil and the laboratory work skills that I learned under George. And kind of that's what I've turned my group into at Stony Brook.
Did you always have an idea of the direction you wanted to go in? Or was that something that kind of coalesced as you came to the end of that journey?
Well, I think it was the latter. Like I said, when I started out, I was an astronomy major and I was looking at quasars through a small telescope in upstate New York. And I was like, this is boring. I didn't like it at all. And you know, for some people, that's not boring. And those are the people who do that, right? And
of course.
I think that's fantastic. But that's not what I was into.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember a specific moment. It was the summer of 97 when Pathfinder landed, and I was at Williams College doing a summer internship, and I remember watching that. It was the 4th of July, you know, United States Independence Day, and it just blew my mind, you know, and I said, yeah, seeing the pictures from Eris Vallis for the first time, there's another world. And I was alive, but I was very young during the Viking missions, and so that didn't really resonate with me, but that really resonated with me. Pathfinder. And so that's what really kind of set me off. It was really an inspirational experience just watching that on TV, seeing the cover, you know, seeing the surface of Mars on the cover of Time magazine. You know, people really got a kick out of that. It was the first time we'd been to Mars in 15 years at that point. It was a big deal, which was kind of neat to see. But that's what really kind of made me think that I could go in that direction, because I saw the scientists on TV talking about it. They were mini celebrities for a small amount of time, and they were talking with such enthusiasm, And that was kind of a transformational experience for me as far as where my direction, you know, that I decided to go in and for my career.
You hear that a lot when speaking to people that work in the industry. Those moments, the shuttle launches, the landings on other planets, mm-hmm. or even something like Star Trek has a big effect.
Sure.
You have these kind of moments which have a definite effect on the direction of that people decide to take.
Yeah, and for the generation before me, it was Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the people that are 10, 20 years before me who were children watching the astronauts walk on the moon, that was their transformational experience. And that's what inspired them to get into, you know, whether it was an engineering field or a science field or planetary science. It, you know, it's not just these types of missions don't just inspire people to go into planetary science. It inspires them to follow a technical field, whether they go into engineering or technology or math, you know, so one of the STEM fields. And I think that's one of the virtues of planetary exploration beyond just the knowledge that we gain from exploration. It's really this inspiration for the young generation and pushing them towards a career in one of the technical fields.
Maybe we could discuss a little bit about what your research focus is now.
Mm-hmm. Part of my research is focused on Mars and using remote sensing data sets primarily. So instruments that are in orbit or were in orbit around Mars to learn about what the minerals are on the surface. And I'm primarily interested in minerals that can only be there because water was there. And so when we have the interaction of water with the primary igneous rocks on the surface, we make things like clays and sulfates, carbonates and salt, other salts that on Earth we know form when water interacts with those rocks. And so today, NASA is all about finding habitable environments. When I was a grad student, it was follow the water, find the water. And then that turned into, we found the water. We found the water hundreds of times. You know, we had a press conference a few weeks ago where they found water again, right? Yeah. So we found water lots of times. Now it's find the habitable environments. And I'll tell you, in 5 years or 10 years, if we found habitable environments and, you know, 10 times, and we have a press conference every few weeks because we found a new habitable environment on Mars, then I'll be really happy. But one thing that we can use to try to find those habitable environments are minerals that are indicators of the long-term interaction of water with rocks. And so that's one thing that I do, is I use these remote sensing data sets. And I have a laboratory at Stony Brook where we do different types of experiments to help us interpret those remote sensing data where quantitatively, where we say, okay, this remote sensing signal means this, or it means that, but it helps us understand what that remote sensing signature means, what the mineral indicator, you know, actually means. And so we work with geochemists and other geologists who can help us interpret the geological formation environment of the infrared, you know, signals that we're, you know, that we see. So for Mars, that's always been my focus, is water on the surface. How did it get there? How long was it there? And what clues did that water leave behind that we can sense, you know, from satellites in orbit around Mars? You're primarily using infrared radiation. That's the longer wavelength than our eyes can see. For the moon, it was a much less direct path. You know, I do a lot of lunar research as well. I was a brand new professor at Stony Brook, trying to write a lot of grants to fund myself and fund graduate students. And there was a new spacecraft going to the moon called Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that is still there. And the science teams for the instruments on that orbiter were already selected. But NASA has what they call a participating scientist program, where if you're not an original member of the team, you can still say, oh, I could do work with this instrument and I could contribute something to the team that they don't already have. And there's an infrared instrument on Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter called the Diviner Lunar Radiometer Experiment, or just Diviner for short. And it was an infrared radiometer, so it's basically a really fancy thermometer, you know. But it measures the temperature of the moon at different wavelengths, and we can use the temperatures at different wavelengths to tell something about what the composition of the surface is. So I said, well, it's an infrared instrument, and I did infrared spectroscopy of Mars, so I might as well write a proposal. And then it got selected, now the moon is as much a part, or if not more, part of my research program than Mars is. And even though there's no water there and it's not a habitable environment, it's a really interesting unique geologic body. We can use it as a witness plate for the rest of the airless bodies in the solar system, because the processes that are happening on the moon, the interaction of the rocks with the space environment, they happen on every airless body in the solar system. And we have these very detailed measurements of the moon now that we can apply that knowledge we're learning at the moon and apply it to asteroids, apply it to the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, or Phobos and Deimos, the moons of Mars, all by looking at how, you know, the moon evolved over time since its formation. So it's a fascinating body. It gets a lot less respect than it deserves, I think. But I've from knowing nothing about the moon, I've turned into somewhat of a moon evangelist in just a short few years.
I see. What is it about the moon that makes it so special?
There's a few things. One is that to learn about Earth's early history, we really have to look at the moon, because most of Earth's geologic record has been erased by plate tectonics. So we know very little about the early impact bombardment history of Earth, how rocks on Earth evolved over time. But the moon is right next door, you know, from the standpoint of the solar system. So we can use the moon and the ancient rocks that we see on the moon. We have a 4.56 billion-year-old rock from the moon, right? And we can see the craters there. We can see how the rocks evolved over time on the moon using the amounts of craters that we see there. And that tells us a lot about what the environment was like very early in Earth's history as well. The period of Earth's history that we call the Hadean, meaning hell-like. That all of that is erased from Earth's rock record, right? But we have the moon right next door, and that tells us, you know, looking at the ancient, fractured, beat-up crust of the moon gives us a lot of insight into what Earth's very early history was like. We know, for instance, that, you know, the bombardment rate very early in the solar system history was very high, and we see these huge impact basins on the moon, thousands of kilometers across. Things that big were hitting Earth, too, at that time. In fact, it was a giant impact, something about the size of Mars, that hit Earth, that formed the moon in the first place. So when we start thinking about really big questions, like, when did life start? We have to take this into account. We have to think, gosh, there were huge things hitting Earth. What types of environments did that create? Did life start and then was snuffed out by a giant impact and then start again? Or did life just wait to happen until kind of the bombardment, you know, settled down? You know, so we learn about that early bombardment history by looking at the moon. We learn about the history of the Earth-Moon interaction by looking at the moon. We probably have life on Earth because we have a moon, you know, stabilizing our orbit and our obliquity. That probably contributes to why we have a habitable environment on Earth. So all of these things, you know, make the moon important for understanding Earth. But I think also the moon is just a unique geologic body. And if you care about geology and you're a geology nerd like I am, it evolved differently than Earth did over time, very obviously. It's smaller. Volcanism and, you know, geologic activity was snuffed out on the moon earlier than Earth is. And we have no two terrestrial bodies in the solar system that are alike. Earth is different from Venus, is different from Mars, is different from the moon. And by studying each of these and kind of taking a comparative planetology approach, you know, we can learn about how geologic processes in general operate. And so I think the moon is a very key piece of that.
Do you read about other small bodies in the solar system, like, say, the Jovian moons or the Saturnian moons, and you're able to use what you've learned there and apply it out further out?
Certainly, they are very different, geologically speaking, from what we see in the inner solar system. They're primarily icy bodies. I'd have to say, if you probably wanted to pick any two bodies in the solar system and say, oh, those are about as like as you can get, you could look at, say, Dione and Rhea. You know, those are basically big cratered ice balls. But, you know, just being, you know, in the Saturn system or the Jupiter system is going to influence what they're like. So you have to, there's so many external factors that influence a planet or a planetary body's evolution over time. And I think the recent results from Pluto tell us that we still have very little idea about what those influences are. I think, you know, I'm probably not alone in thinking that when New Horizons got to Pluto and sent us the images back of Charon and Pluto, that they'd be pretty bland, boring, heavily cratered ice balls, very similar to a Jovian moon or Saturnian moon. That's the exact opposite of what we saw. They are these very rich geologic worlds where active processes are still happening today. And I still haven't heard anybody explain anything about why they look like that. And that's fascinating. And it'll probably take another mission to go there and, you know, give us a tenth of a percent of the story. So we still have a lot to learn. And that's kind of the one of the exciting things is we never get bored as planetary scientists. If you get bored as a planetary scientist, you should be doing something else because there's always something new.
What kind of advice do you have for somebody who wants to try and go down this route?
There's one really easy piece of advice, and that is develop your quantitative skill sets as much as possible. Take as much math and as much physics as your schedule allows while still learning something about rocks, right? you know, one of my advantages that I had coming out of undergrad is I took a lot more math than was required for my major, and I had a really strong physics background compared to a lot of people who are just, say, a geology major and want to go into planetary science. Even at Stony Brook, our geology majors are only required to take 2 semesters of calculus and 2 semesters of physics and chemistry. But I think if you develop more quantitative skills, and, you know, computer programming is very useful in a lot of data analysis, then that makes analyzing data, doing laboratory work, and more importantly, interpreting the data that you're working with much more easy. And so I think that is a key that's missing from a lot of applicants that I see coming into our graduate program or applying to our graduate program is, you know, they have a great geology background, which is needed, definitely, if you want to study planetary surfaces. But when it comes down to really understanding what you're looking at, you know, remote sensing, which we do, is all about the interaction of light photons with matter. And you really want to understand at a fundamental level what is going on there. That requires a substantial background in physics and math. So take as much as you can and do well. And, you know, the one last story. You know, when I was an undergraduate, my 2 worst grades that I got, one was in linear algebra in math, and now all the data processing I do is essentially matrix transformations in linear algebra, and the other was E&M, electricity and magnetism in physics, which basically is what I've turned my entire career into. And so my professors are probably shaking their heads. But even, you know, getting C pluses in those courses gave me, you know, the very basic tools I needed to, once I went to grad school and started really learning the nuts and bolts of how light interacts with matter and then how that turns into a mineralogical interpretation of a planetary surface, it was a lot more background than other people had, and I think it benefited me quite a bit.
And now for the roundtable discussion. Well, that was a really interesting interview with Tim Glotch from Stony Brook. What did you think about the interview, Poshti?
I really enjoyed it because it was not just about one thing, right? Like, he was doing Mars and then the Moon. There was a lot of like cross connections there. Basically, what planetary science is, interdisciplinary. Yeah. So you're, you know, applying a lot of things from one or the other places. But it was kind of fun to hear that no single object in the solar system is alike. Because, you know, you do have some similarities and kind of draw what you learn from one to the other. So, yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, the fact that there's so much large variety and there's so much to learn. There's so much still left in dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's still so much to find. I found it really interesting, like, listening to
how he became involved with Mars and the process of being a professor and having to write lots of grant proposals and all this kind of stuff, which is which I think is actually something that you know a little bit about from your work, like how to do that. And it's obviously not an easy thing to try and do. I mean, I don't know if you want to like tell the listeners a little bit about your experience in that area.
Yeah, so for my PhD, so for my master's, I did research on massive stars, but these are almost like, you know, what we call adult stars, not really that young. They have, you know, basically they're doing what the sun does right now. But then I switched gears in my PhD when I was studying, again, massive stars, but this time they're very, very young. So you are kind of using your knowledge from studying disks around these adult massive stars to kind of, they're called BE stars, and then transfer that knowledge to these young stars about whose disks we don't really know much about. So, you know, I liked hearing how he loved astronomy when he started, and, you know, he was looking at the you know, objects in the universe through the telescope, and he didn't find that interesting. But then, hey, he has a background in physics that he could then apply in the geology and kind of mix the two and, you know, have a background in geophysics. And then obviously, like, once you finish a PhD, you want to apply as postdoc to other places, and you have to come up with new research things you're going to do, right? Like, it's always, yes, you learn something from a topic that you studied for your PhD, you move on to either expand on that topic or apply the knowledge or physics that you have learned basically to other objects in the universe. And I think his path was exactly, you know, what a standard professor's path would be. And, you know, writing proposals is part of your graduate student training, which is great if anyone ever has a chance to apply to either get some time on a telescope, which I did in my PhD, luckily, which I didn't end up using any of the data in my PhD. They're still lying around being researched on. I do it on my weekends. But the experience of actually thinking of an idea, explaining it to why they should give you these two precious hours on these giant telescopes that, trust me, so many people fight for the time because, you know, they are big telescopes that can give you a lot of important data. And so that process is applying as a principal investigator, what kind of things you need to take care of, for example, learning about what the instruments can do, what the telescope can do, and where it's located too. You could have a southern hemisphere telescope that could look at certain stars in the southern hemisphere, but then a northern one may not be able to look at them. So you have to, there are a lot of things that you learn that you don't think about when you already have a data and you're just processing it. You don't see the fact of what goes into getting them. And these proposals kind of give you that idea of, you know, thinking beyond just your research area and what you need to encompass to do what you want to do. And so proposals give you really kind of important background and also, you know, an idea of what you could do.
Yeah.
And that's something that you may not have thought before writing a proposal. So proposals are really important in graduate student training, and something that if you go on to be a postdoc or a professor, that's something that's useful.
Because you always get the impression that the writing of proposals, for whatever reason, is always very, you know, it's like the least fun thing. So it's interesting to hear from the standpoint of somebody who's done that, that actually you can get some very interesting and important information out of it and learn some skills from it that will actually help you in your other work.
Yeah, and certainly something that you mentioned, that it doesn't always go, you know, it doesn't always get accepted. And that's something that happened with me. Like, mine wasn't accepted, but it wasn't rejected either. It was kind of put on a possible list. So there are certain grades where it gets you to that they're absolutely going to do it. And then there's the middle stack, which is like, okay, we'll try for it. And then there, the below stack, which is like, no, we're not going to do this. So mine was in the middle stack where it was like, we'll try, you know, if there's a possibility, and then we'll do it. And yeah, I got all the data that I had asked for at the end. It's just that there is no guarantee. And that has to do with a lot of things, depending on what the other proposals are, what they're actually looking for. For example, if there was a proposal at that time looking for, I don't know, gravitational waves or something. I'm just throwing things out. But there was, you know, a recent discovery that could be amplified or could have something to do with what they're looking at. That would get more attention and importance than, you know, some other of the projects. And it's competition. So you're competing against other proposals. And you don't know what other proposals are. So kind of have to give your best and then just wait for it and then retry, and they give you comments back too. So the good thing about at least the CFHT proposals that I was doing, the Canada France Hawaii telescope, was that they give you feedback on where was the proposal lacking, which could have made it stronger. So that gives you, you know, something to learn as well, where you had not thought about, hey, maybe I could use this kind of smaller telescope to do the same thing that I'm asking to do on the bigger telescope, and that's something they would suggest. And, you know, if it's possible, certainly you can use a smaller telescope. But it's all a learning process of writing grants and asking for money and or time.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by John Kissy and Parshti Patel and featured an interview by co-host John Kissy. Our roundtable discussion featured John Kissy, Parshti Patel, and Dana Beaton. And our editors were John Kissy and Dana Beaton. And I am John Kissy. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online, listen to our past episodes, and learn more about Western Worlds by going to our website at www.uwo.ca/westernworlds. We are available on Twitter and Facebook, Internet Archive, and SoundCloud. On behalf of everybody at Western Worlds, I would like to thank you for joining us. We hope you will join us again next time, here on Western Worlds. Thank you.